From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, we hear from both Democratic candidates, State Senator Royce West and MJ Hager, in the runoff for the U.S. Senate nomination and the chance to challenge Republican Senator John Cornyn. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. During the November 3rd general election, Texans will cast a vote for U.S. Senator. Republican incumbent John Cornyn is seeking re-election, but who will be the challenger from the Democratic Party? That's being decided now. Early voting is underway for the runoff. Election day is July 14th. The candidates are State Senator Royce West and MJ Hager. We're going to hear from both. First up, State Senator Royce West. I asked him why he decided to run.
Yeah, we have a president and unfortunately a senator that's followed this president as it relates to making this country more polarized. When you begin to look at the issues of importance, Donald Trump set the stage when he responded to what happened in Charlottesville, when white nationalists, neo-Nazis, had a march, and then the ensuing death and injury of protesters that were against that march. Donald Trump, as opposed to coming out and trying to heal the country, further polarized the country, saying there are good people on both sides of the issue. John Cornyn didn't stand up and say anything of any substance about that. And when you begin to look at issues concerning health care in this particular country, what is John Cornyn and Donald Trump done? The goal of the president is to try to erase everything that Barack Obama did. The ghost of Barack Obama is always over his shoulder, and he's trying to make certain that he erases everything. And John Cornyn's right there with him. Look at the Affordable Care Act. Who has it benefited? It's benefited millions of Texans without insurance in this state. 20 million people, over 20 million people in this country. But yet and still, Donald Trump, John Cornyn, wants it repealed without a plan in place. John Cornyn is out of touch with the values of Texans in the 21st century. We need a person that's in touch with that and that with those values, and will work to make certain that all Texans are represented in the United States Senate. And that's exactly what I will do.
Currently, we are in a state of crisis, a national disaster with COVID-19. What do you think needs to be happening now with trying to help the country deal with this virus?
I think that the country has finally came to grips with the fact that we need a new president. When do you have a leader whose administration is recommending to the people of the country a particular course of action, and he goes the opposite direction on a continuous basis, as opposed to, again, trying to bring the country together behind one particular strategy? What he's doing is continuously dividing and politicizing the country from that particular standpoint. And so what we need to do is this. We need to make certain that, number one, that we deal with all of the issues that I'm confronted with as a state senator. The reason why I didn't start off earlier in the runoff election is because I had to make certain that constituents in my senatorial district was being their issues were being handled, from being able to file unemployment compensation claims, in terms of people who were trying to figure out whether or not they were going to be evicted, in terms of people that didn't have food to eat, issues like that. When schools began to close down, we had to deal with those issues. And now, as a state senator and also as a United States Senate candidate, I've got to make certain that as we begin to open up schools again, that I'm here for my constituents, as I will be for Texans as a United States senator, to make certain that whatever role the federal government needs to play as a United States senator, that I make certain that we play that role to make certain schools have the resources that are necessary, to make certain that as unemployment claims issues begin to come up again, given that the administration is talking about ending the $600 a month PUC, we need to make certain that people aren't left out of the cold. We know that recent labor numbers indicate that there's about 12 to 14 million people still unemployed. And with this latest closing that we're having, or in terms of businesses, there'll be additional persons that will be unemployed. We've got to look out for those persons, which means not only do we have to look out for the unemployment compensation, but they're going to be longer food lines. And in addition, we've got to make certain that the testing is completed. You know, one thing that I'm not able to get from the state of Texas is the breakdown on the positive results by ethnicity. For some strange reason, there is no strategy statewide to be able to get those numbers together to make a determination exactly where we need to focus treatment efforts. But that's another story, because that shows the economic inequities of the COVID situation. And we know which communities are going to be hardest hit, not only as a result of the virus itself, but also unemployment and also increasing of the education gap if we don't put a SWAT team holistic approach in those particular communities that makes certain that those issues are addressed.
So speaking of the economy in the COVID-19 response, we are seeing increasing layoffs and bankruptcies. People are going to be hurting if they're not already hurting. If you were in the U.S. Senate, what kind of action would you be working towards to try to help the economy recover and help people who are in dire need?
You know, my background is that of a budget writer in the Texas Senate. I have been on the Finance Committee for a long period of time. And this is not my first rodeo as it relates to economic stress in this country and this state. We've got to have people. Number one, we need to listen to the economic experts to make a determination in terms of what their recommendations are. And the policymakers have got to put this issue of healing our economy ahead of any politics. You know, I don't know too many people that don't want to work. Most people do want to work so they can provide for themselves. So that ought to be the premise that we move forward with. We've got to also recognize that in order for people to work, they have to have a job. In order for them to have a job, frankly, you have to have a business. And so there has to be a delicate balance between, number one, not putting profit above public health, but making certain that we incrementally open up this economy so that persons can be employed, so that sales tax can be paid, so that services can be provided to the public, which the public obviously wants to make certain continues as it has in the past.
We're seeing these statues coming down of these once revered figures who are now seen in a new light of social justice as oppressors and racist. During the last legislative session in Austin, there was a bill that would have protected these statues in Texas, and you were very present in working to defeat that bill. Given what we're seeing now with these protests, can you talk about why you worked so hard to keep that bill from passing?
First of all, I disagree with your premise. They're not revered. The fact is, some people may very well revere them, but the great majority of Texans and Americans don't revere them. The fact is that the Confederacy, they were treasonous. In order to heal the country, they were pardoned. But let's make certain history.
Sure, but in my own defense, I said once revered figures.
Okay. They once revered figures. I'll go along with that. They were revered by some people in the Confederacy.
Sure, okay? In the power structure of the time, during Jim Crow, the people who built statues and stuff, they built these things. But now, hopefully,
okay,
we're beyond that.
No, I understand it, but I just didn't want to agree with the premise of the statement. The way I look at it is like this. They were traitors, okay? And they should have been tried for treason. But in order to heal the country, the government decided to pardon them. And the fact is, we still hadn't dealt with those issues, and we're dealing with them now. I should not have to, or any African-American shouldn't have to go to, or a Hispanic shouldn't have to go to the Capitol and be faced with seeing those portraits of persons that were frankly traitors. And then when you begin to look at the Articles of Succession here in the state of Texas, it specifically says in 1861 why they decided to succeed. It was about slavery. It was about enslaving my ancestors. And I'm the descendants of those persons. And so I should not, and others should not, think for one minute that we have embraced the Confederacy, because we haven't. And yes, I'm glad people of good conscience are now coming together to say that, yes, those statues have a place in history, and they should be in a museum where those persons that revere them can go study them and understand exactly what they stood for in that point in time in history. I think that's kind of when you begin to look at the Black Lives Matter movement, you begin to see that the death of George Floyd, didn't get up that morning thinking he was going to die that day, but he died as a result, frankly, is changing the world in terms of the criminal justice issues, the police reforms, and the holistic approach to dealing with racism in this country. When I participated in protest in Dallas and Austin, it was real clear to me that the great majority of persons that were at those protests are registered to vote and that they're going to vote. They're going to take that energy that's been generated as a result of these protests and they're going to turn it towards the ballot and they're going to vote. They're going to be voting for persons that, frankly, are progressive on these issues and have a history of dealing with these issues, and they understand and appreciation that experience matters, and they know that in this race for the United States Senate that I have been faithful to attempting to deal with these issues and that I will do so as a member of the United States Senate.
If you are elected to the U.S. Senate, will there be concern or an effort, or will you be part of some sort of move to restore presidential oversight and limit the power of the executive branch, given what we've seen, what many have seen from what's happened with Donald Trump?
I think that Congress needs to make certain it's not that it does its constitutional duty, period. And it just hasn't done that under the Trump administration. The Senate has been complicit in allowing the executive branch of government to have too much power, power that the Constitution never envisioned it to have.
The Voting Rights Act has been gutted by the Supreme Court. There's been a bill passed in the House. It was not taken up in the Senate that would restore the Voting Rights Act. Would you, if you were in the Senate, work to bring the Voting Rights Act back into its full body?
Yes, I would. I would vote on making certain that the Voting Rights Act, every law can be modified somewhat, but I'd look at modifications that were necessary, but it would be my intent to vote for a modified Voting Rights Act.
What kind of qualities will you be looking for in a Supreme Court justice?
I'm going to want to see someone that's going to be fair. I want to be able to look at a person's background to see exactly what they've been doing, whether they've leaned left or right, or whether they have basically interpreted the law the way that it was meant in the Constitution, that judges interpret the law, not make law, but interpret the law. And so from that standpoint, I'm going to want to look at their particular record on those types of issues. But what I will say is thank God for Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And you are an attorney, so you have an awareness of the law.
Oh, yes. I've been practicing law for the past 40 years. Currently, I have a business, so I have a business perspective, 27 years of legislative perspective where I've dealt with passing laws concerning body cameras. One of the first laws in this country passed concerning body cameras was passed here in the state of Texas. Racial profiling, I've dealt with education issues in terms of teacher pay raises, creating universities, and trying very hard to make education more affordable for students, specific college students, and I also want to make certain that we have a 14 years of paid education as opposed to 12 that would enable students to go to community college, 2 years of university of vocational training, and also want to see at least a $15 minimum wage in this country.
State Senator Royce West is in the runoff for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate. Also in the runoff is MJ Hager. I asked MJ Hager why she decided to run.
I am a combat veteran, a working mom, and somebody who grew up here in Texas in a working class family in very rural Texas. I spent 12 years in the military and 5 years working in healthcare. Lots of people know about the military. They don't know I worked in healthcare during the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, actually. I got laid off from that job shortly after having my first kiddo. And then I spent 2 years in tech. I have an undergraduate degree and an executive MBA from UT. So that's me. And I am running for the Senate as a fulfillment of the oath that I took to support and defend our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I believe strongly that some of the things that we are seeing are a domestic threat to our Constitution. but also because of my ardent desire to protect the world that my two boys and all of our kids, frankly, are growing up into, and the country that they'll be inheriting from us. You know, when I was a private citizen working in healthcare, I took on the powerful forces in D.C. To open hundreds of thousands of jobs up for women, and was told I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be effective because I wasn't inside the system. I wasn't a big, powerful donor. I didn't have political capital, is what I learned what political capital was, apparently. I didn't have access to those cigar smoke filled rooms. And yet I was able to build a broad bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats to make sure that the military could open those jobs, and the people like Jeff Sessions couldn't legislate a stop to that opening like they were trying to do. And while I was there, you know, just on my time off from work, I just looked around and wondered why more people couldn't do that. And there's just a real lack of authenticity. There's a real lack of values-based collaboration, if you will. Most decisions are made by people answering calls from their corporate donors or what the polls say, or, you know, listening to their party leadership and doing as they're told. And not enough people just putting their community first. And what I also saw when I looked around was a lot of people who didn't understand the actual challenges of regular people like us. And I think that that's a problem with not having term limits, and a problem with having career politicians, is that, for example, John Cornyn does not work hard to protect Social Security because he's on three taxpayer-funded pensions and doesn't worry about it. He doesn't think we have a broken healthcare system because he doesn't take part in our healthcare system. It's a real problem when you have the people who are making decisions disconnected from the realities of those of us on the ground.
Now, we're in a national emergency, a nationwide disaster with the COVID-19. Can you talk about the administration's and the government's response to COVID and what you would do differently?
That's a big question, because we have the healthcare component and the economic component. It's one of the most pressing questions right now. And so I'm going to take a couple minutes, because the public health component, I do believe it's tied in with the economic component, because I'm a big supporter of small businesses. And I think that the public health component is really killing small businesses right now. And so really the question is, how do we get the public health crisis under control? And then how do we fix the economic piece? As somebody from the military and from my time in healthcare, by the way, who is trained in crisis management, I have a real concern with the lack of data-driven decision-making. And what I mean by that is we have rubrics, both in the military and in healthcare, on handling emergencies and crises that say things like, you know, when the ICU bed capacity gets to this number, or when cases get to this number, then these actions automatically take effect. We don't have that right now. What we have is leadership making decisions politically motivated based on public pressure or what party leaders are telling them to do. Things like, for example, downplaying COVID, which is something that John Cornyn does all the time on Twitter still, I believe, saying things like with social distancing, this will be a walk in the park or a piece of cake or whatever it was he said. My first thought when I read that was, there's a man who doesn't buy his own toilet paper, who isn't worried that you know, he has a family member that's sick or is going to lose his job, or although he should be worried he's going to lose his job at this point, but he's not going to lose his access to healthcare. He's not worried about the things we're worried about. So I'm also worried that we're not seeing enough about, I mean, it seems like the conversation is around masks or closing, and there's no talk about testing and contact tracing. And I truly believe that until we have that, I mean, every time we see a record number, We don't need to be looking at what actions are we taking right now that's causing it. We should be looking at what actions did we take or did we not take 2 weeks ago that caused us to be where we are now. So without adequate access to testing and having it covered, by the way, a lot of people are finding that that's not even covered by their insurance because we have a broken healthcare system. We're not going to be able to get the public health part of this under control. Now, the economic piece, I believe that, again, as somebody who waited tables and was a bartender, the service industry is not going to be able to recover while we have leaders fumbling the recovery of the public health piece, okay? But as far as what we can do from the federal government for the economy, I do think there's too many people in DC right now prioritizing the ultra wealthy and CEOs, looking at the stock market as the only harbinger of the economy. completely ignoring the record unemployment numbers we have when we have a healthcare system that is employer provided, that's tied to employment. So, you know, I hope that this election, we're able to put people in power who are going to be able to make decisions that can recover the economy for regular working Texans instead of just looking at the stock market. Now, don't get me wrong, the stock market is important too. A lot of people's retirements are tied to that and things like that, but it's not the only thing we should be looking at. We have relief packages that are going out without the transparency and accountability that were written into them. We have businesses run by people of color not having access to the relief, which is not something new. We've seen that with FEMA relief and other problems. So we have systemic racism intertwined in all of this, healthcare disparities and things like that. So we just need to start electing leaders who understand these issues and approach things with a holistic approach and understand how they're not siloed and how they actually interchange with each other. The last thing I'll say is I spent 5 years working in healthcare, and the first thing you learn in healthcare is listen to nurses. We're not listening to our essential workers. We're not giving them what they need, the PPE and the guidelines and restrictions. And that was a red flag for me back in March.
To bring the focus back to the economy, and you mentioned the stock market, and the stock market is not the economy for many people. The kitchen table, that's the economy for many people. And right now, with growing layoffs and bankruptcies in the United States due to COVID-19 and the response, people are losing their kitchen tables. It's not just an empty table anymore. It's the table's going away. What can we do for those people?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that that problem is going to continue to get worse. When you have people in a position to do something about it, making their decisions purely out of self-interest and getting reelected and what do the polls say, instead of listening to science and modeling and data and making those decisions. We've seen other states, we've seen other countries do this much better. We should be looking at best practices. Early on in February and March, we were declining testing help from the World Health Organization. That is a politically motivated decision. We just really need to do something that I haven't seen in my lifetime, and that is have legislators and representatives who are actually representative of us instead of a political class of career politicians who, even if they're well-intended, you know, those career politicians who don't surround themselves with people who ground them, who don't invite voices to the table in their policymaking and give them a voice in crafting their decision-making, because I think that there is a way to guard against it. I do think there are some people who have been in politics their whole career that can be servant leaders, but you actually have to force yourself out of the echo chamber in order to do that. So I do think, you know, supporting small businesses, ensuring the money is going where it needs to go instead of going to people who have a good old boys network and already have accountants and attorneys in place to be able to snatch up the PPP loans and things like that. You know, we're not going to have an economy that recovers for us, for regular working Texans.
Current scandal at the White House involves allegations that the Taliban was paid death bounties by Russia for U.S. soldiers. Trump had been briefed on this, according to the allegation, and he ignored the information, and then he continued to do favors for Putin. Do you believe this is the chain of events, and what's your reaction?
So this is obviously a very emotional issue for me. I was a medevac pilot. I did 3 tours in Afghanistan. I medevaced soldiers and civilians off the battlefield, and not all of them made it. And you know, the depth of pain from the families who lost service members. I'll never forget the first soldier that I lost, and his 8-year-old daughter and his parents in Texas, by the way, devastated. Those things stay with you. And it is unconscionable that we have an administration and a president that doesn't read their intelligence reports. That was a concern for me from the get-go when I heard that, as somebody who has a top secret security clearance myself, you know, blowing those off, because gosh, I'm having a hard time articulating this because I'm furious.
So first of all, do you believe it? Do you believe this happened?
You know, it absolutely happened. You know, there is very clear evidence that it happened. There may be disagreements on how things happened, but there is a very clear trail of electronic transfers. There was $500,000 found. The more that we learn about this, it definitely happened while I was there. People were killed with weapons that we were briefed on was supplied by Russia and training supplied by Russia. Before you go on a mission, you get told, okay, avoid these coordinates with a, you know, 2 mile radius of this, and we draw a bubble around it, and you get briefed on this is an SA-6 or whatever. It was supplied by Russia, trained by these people. And like, we know they are our enemy. Okay. They are getting people killed. And by the way, when you pay to have someone killed, there are people on death row right now that have done that. That is murder. All right. It is an act of war. And I am furious at John Cornyn's silence and his selective outrage, because if a Democratic president had done this, he would be all over it. We got to stop asking ourselves what party affiliation the person who did the action or didn't take action is before we decide if we're outraged. I'm outraged, and I would be outraged at anybody who advocated for Russia to be added to the G7, advocated for, you know, Russia is our enemy, not understanding and not equating, having a president who doesn't equate a leader and a country as our enemy just because he's not his personal enemy. I think that there's too much of that going on, that you know, if it personally benefits this president, he equates that to benefiting the country. Not taking seriously the election security. There's too many things here to even talk about that I'm concerned about. It's one of the main reasons I'm running. I feel a strong sense of responsibility to the next generation putting on the uniform, that we provide them with the most secure national security and foreign policy environment as possible. We've got to walk back the gutting of the State Department and the decades-long career diplomats that have served under both parties. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I think it's going to take a decade to recover our reputation on a global stage.
Can you talk about why you are a Democrat?
Yeah, I can talk about when I realized I was a Democrat, and I think that you know, helps. I was raised in a very rural Republican household, most of us just believe what our parents believe until we start to experience the world. Our household was always a pro-choice, pro-LGBT household that was, you know, a Republican household only because under Reagan, they were making decisions. The adults in my family were making decisions on who to vote for based on national security and based on wanting to keep limited government and local control of government. Those things don't exist and haven't for a while as far as down party lines. Those are more things of individuals. There are some Democrats and some Republicans that are well-versed on national security and some that don't know what the hell they're talking about. And neither party has a monopoly on those things. This, you know, this idea of fiscal responsibility is based on person as well. There are some Democrats and Republicans that are fiscally responsible and some that aren't. Limiting the influence of government in our lives is another area that I don't think is one party over another. You know, I believe the government should not come in and tell you who to marry. I believe the government should not come in and tell a woman what to do with her body or when to have children. So, you know, I am a Democrat because I am fighting for comprehensive immigration reform that is better in line with our values. I'm a Democrat because I believe that healthcare is a human right, that climate change is the greatest threat to our children, and that we deserve an economy that works for everyone.
MJ Hager is in the Democratic Party runoff for U.S. Senator. Also on the ballot is Texas State Senator Royce West. We heard from him earlier in the program. The victor of the runoff will challenge incumbent Republican Senator John Cornyn. Early voting for the runoff is underway. Election day is July 14th. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find them wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.